meetest such plain scriptures which speak to that case, go over where it is formidable, and do not venture beyond thy depth. Art thou afraid because thou hast sinned since the knowledge of the truth, and therefore no sacrifice remains for thee? See David and Peter's case, how it patterns thine, and left upon the record that their recovery may be a key in thy hand to open such places as these. Mayest thou not safely conclude from these, this is not their meaning, that none can be saved that sin after knowledge? Indeed, in both these places, it is neither meant of the falls of such as ever had true grace, nor of a falling away in some particular sets of sin, but of a total universal falling away from the faith, the doctrine of it as well as seeming practice of it. Now, in the root of the matter, wherever in thee, other scriptures will first comfort thee against those particular apostasies into which thou hast relapsed, by sweet promises inviting him to return and precedence of saints who have had peace spoken to them after such folly, and also they will satisfy thee against the other by giving full security to thy faith, that thy little grace should not die, being immortal, though not in its proper essence, because a creature, yet by covenant, as it is a child of promise. Thirdly, dark providences. From these Satan disputes against God's love to and grace in a soul. First, he got a commission to plunder Job of his temporal estate and bereave him of his children, and then labors to make him question his spiritual estate and sonship. His wife would have him entertain hard thoughts of God, saying, curse God and die. And his friends as hard thoughts of himself, as if he were a hypocrite, and both upon the same estate, as if such an afflicted condition and gracious state were inconsistent. Now, Christian, keep the plains, and neither from this charge God foolishly, charge God foolishly for thine enemy, nor thyself as his. Read the saddest providence with the comment of the word, and thou canst not make such a harsh interpretation. As God can make a straight line with a crooked stick be righteous when he uses wicked instruments, so also gracious when he dispenses harsh providences. Joseph kept his love when he spake roughly to his brother. I do not wonder that the wicked think they have God's blessings, because they are in the worn sun. Alas, they are strangers to God's counsels, void of his spirit, and sensual, judging of God and his providence by the report present feeling makes of them. Like little children who think everyone loves them that gives them plums. But it is strange that a saint should be at a loss for his afflicted state, who, when he hath a key to decipher God's character. Christian, hath not God secretly instructed thee by his Spirit from the Word how to read the shorthand of his providence? Dost not thou know that the saints' afflictions stand for blessings? Every soul whom he loves he corrects, and prosperity and a wicked state must it not be read a curse? Does not God damn such to be rich, honorable, victorious in this world, as well as to be tormented in another world? God gives them more of these than they seem to desire sometimes, and all to bind them faster up in a deep sleep of security, as Joel served Sisera, Judges 5:25. He shall have milk, though he asked but water, that she might nail him the surer to the ground. Milk having a property as some right to incline to sleep. Section 4. Fourthly, be careful to keep thy old receipts, which thou hast from God for the pardon of thy sins. There are some gaudy days and jubilee-like festivals when God comes forth clothed with the robes of his mercy and holds forth the scepter of his grace more familiarly to his children than ordinarily, bearing witness to their faith, sincerity, etc. And then the firmament is clear, not a cloud to be seen to darken the Christian's comfort. Love and joy are the soul's repast and pastime, while this feast lasts. Now when God withdraws and this cheer is taken off, Satan's work is, how he may deface and wear off the remembrances of this testimony, which the soul so triumphant in for its spiritual standing that he may not have it as an evidence when he shall bring about the suit again, and put the soul to produce his writings for his spiritual state or renounce his claim. It behooves thee, therefore, to lay them up safely. Such a testimony may serve to non-suit thy accuser many years hence. One affirmative from God's mouth for thy pardoned state carries more weight, though of old date, than 1,000 negatives from Satan's. David's songs of old spring in with the light to his soul in his midnight arrows. Question. But what counsel would you give me, saith the distressed soul, who cannot fasten on my former comforts, nor dare to avouch those evidences which once I thought true? I find indeed there have been some treaties of old between God and my soul, some hopes I have had, but these are now so defaced and interlined with backslidings, repentancies, and falls again, that now I question all my evidences, whether true or counterfeit. What shall one in this case do? Answer. First, renew thy repentancy, as if thou hast not never repented. Put forth fresh acts of faith, as if thou hast never believed. This, seriously done, will stop Satan's mouth with an unexpected answer. Let him object against thy former actings as hypocritical. What can he say against thy present repenting and believing, which, if true, sets thee beyond his shot? If it will be harder for Satan to disprove the present workings of God's gracious Spirit, whilst the impressions thereof are fresh, than to pick a hole in thy old deeds and evidences. Acts are transcendent, and as wicked men look at sins committed many years since, as little or none, by reason of that breath of time which interposes, so the Christian, upon the same account, stands at great disadvantage to take the true aspect of those acts of grace which so long ago passed between God and him, though sometimes even these are of great use. As God can make a sinner possess the sins of his youth, as if they were newly acted, to his terror in his old age, so God can present the comforts and evidences which of old the saints received, with those very thoughts he had then of them, as if they were fresh and new. And therefore, secondly, if he haunts thee with fears of thine own spiritual estate, fly thee to the throne of grace and beg a new copy of thine own evidence which thou hast lost. The original is in the pardon office in heaven, whereof Christ is master. If thou art a saint, thy name is upon record in that court. Make thy moans to God. Hear what news from heaven, rather than listen to details which are brought by thine enemy from hell. Did such reason less with Satan and pray over their fears more to God, they might sooner be resolved. Can you expect truth from a liar and comfort from an enemy? Did he ever prophesy well of believers? Was not Job the devil's hypocrite, whom God vouchsafed for a non-such in holiness and proved him so at last? If he knew that thou wert a saint, would he tell thee so? If an hypocrite, he would be as loath thou shouldest know it. Turn thy back there forth on him, and go to thy God. Fear not, but sooner or later he will give his hand again to thy certificate. But look, thou dost not pass rashly a censure on thyself, because a satisfactory answer is not presently sent by thy desire. The messenger may stay long and bring good news at last. Thirdly, shun battle with thine enemy till thou art in a fitter posture, and that thou mayest draw into thy trenches and make an honorable retreat into those fastnesses and strengths which Christ hath provided for his sick and wounded soldiers. Now there are two places of advantage into which deserted souls may retire: the name of God and the absolute promises of the gospel. These I may call the fair havens. They are then chiefest of use when the storm is so great that the ship cannot live at sea. O, saith Satan, Dost thou hope to see God? None but the pure in heart shall be blessed with that vision. Thinkest thou to have comfort? That is the portion of the mourners in spirit. Now so, though thou canst not say, in the hurry of temptation, thou art the pure and the mourner in spirit, yet then say thou, believest God is able to work these in thee? Yea, hath promised such a mercy to poor sinners. It is his covenant. He will give us a new heart, a clean heart, a soft heart. And there I wait, knowing as there was nothing in the creature to move the great God to make such promises. So there can be nothing in the creature to hinder the Almighty, his performance of them, where and when he pleaseth. This act of faith, accompanied with a long desire after that grace thou canst not yet find, and an attendance on the means, though it will not fully satisfy all thy doubts, may be, yet will keep thy head above water, that thou despairest not. In such a shore thou nearest, in this case, or the house falls. Fourthly, if yet Satan's dogs be, call in help, and heed not the devil's counsel. The very strength of some temptations lie in the concealing of them, and the very revealing of them to some faithful friend, like the opening and pricking of an imposthume, gives the soul present ease. Satan knows this too well, and therefore, as some thieves, when they come to rob an house, either gag them in it or hold a pistol to their breast, frightening them with death if they cry or speak. Thus Satan, that he may the more freely rifle the soul of its peace and comfort, overawes it so that it dares not disclose its temptation. O, saith Satan, if thy brethren or friends know such a thing by thee, they will cast thee off, others will hoot at thee. Thus many a poor soul hath been kept long in its pangs by biting them in. Thou losest, Christian, a double help by keeping the devil's secret, the counsel and the prayers of thy fellow brethren, and what an invaluable loss it is. The Christian in Complete Armor by William Grinnell. Ephesians 6, verse 11. Chapter 5, under that, chapter 8. Of the saints' victory over their subtile enemy, and whence it is that creatures so overmatched should be able to stand against Satan's willies. The second branch of the apostles' argument follows, to excite them the more vigorously to their arms, and that is from the possibility, yea, certainty of standing against this subtle enemy, if thus armed, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil, so that this gives the apostles' argument its due temperament. For he meant not to scare them into a cowardly flight, or sudden despair of victory, when he tells them their enemy is so subtle and politic, but to excite them to a vigorous resistance from the assured hope of strength to stand in battle and victoriously after it, which too, I conceive, are comprehended in that phrase, standing against the willies of Satan. Sometimes to stand implies a fighting posture, so verse 14. Sometimes a conquering posture, Job 19:25. I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. That earth which was the field where all the bloody battles were fought between him and Satan, on it shall he stand, when not an enemy shall dare to show his head. So that taking both these in, the observation is, Doctor, Satan, with all his wits and willies, shall never vanquish a soul armed with true grace. Nay, he that hath this armor of God on shall vanquish him. Look into the word. You shall not find a saint, but hath seen in the list with him, sifted and winnowed, more or less, by his enemy. Yet at last we find them all coming off with an honorable victory, as in David, Job, Peter, Paul, who were the hardest put to it of any upon record, and least some should attribute their victory to the strength of their inherent grace above other of their weaker brethren. You have the glory of victories appropriated to God, in which the weak are as strong as the strongest. 2 Corinthians 12:9, James 5:21. We shall give a double reason of this truth, why the Christian who seems to be so overmatched is yet so unconquerable. Reason 1. First, the curse that lies upon Satan and his cause. God's curse blasts wherever it comes. The Canaanites, with their neighbor nations, were bred for Israel. Though people famous for war, and why? They were cursed nations. The Egyptians, a politic people, let us deal wisely, say they. Yet, being cursed of God, this lay like a thorn at their heart, and was at last their ruin. Yea, let the Israelites themselves, who carry the badge of God's covenant on their flesh, by their sins once became the people of God's curse, and they are trampled like dirt under the Assyrian's foot. This made Balak beg so hard for a curse upon Israel. Now there is an irrevocable curse cleaves to Satan from Isaiah 10:5, Genesis 3:14 and 15. And the Lord said to the serpent, because thou hast done this, thou art cursed, etc. Which place the partly meant of the literal serpent, yet certainly of the devil and the wicked, his spiritual serpentine brood, as appears by the enmity pronounced against the serpent's seed and the woman's, which clearly holds forth the feud between Christ with his seed against the devil and his. Now, there are two things in that curse which may comfort the saints. First, the curse prostrates Satan under their feet. Upon thy belly shalt thou go, which is no more than is elsewhere promised, that God will subdue Satan under our feet. Now this prostrate condition of Satan assures believers that the devil shall never lift his head, that is his willing policy, higher than the saint's heel. He may make thee limp, but not bereave thee of thy life. And this bruise which he gives thee shall be rewarded with the breaking of his own head, that is, the utter ruin of him and his cause. Secondly, his food is here limited and appointed. Satan shall not devour whom he will. The dust is his food, which seems to restrain his power to the wicked, who are of the earth earthly, mere dust. But for those who are of a heavenly extraction, their graces are reserved for Christ's food. Canticle 7, verse 13. And their souls surely are not a morsel for the devil's tooth. The second reason is taken from the wisdom of God, who, as he undertakes the ordering of the Christian's way to heaven, Psalms 37, verse 24, so especially this business of Satan's temptations. We find Christ was not led of the evil spirit into the wilderness to be tempted, but of the Holy Spirit. Matthew 4, verse 1. Satan tempts not when he will, but when God pleases. And the same Holy Spirit, which led Christ into the field, brought him off with victory. And therefore we find him marching in the power of the Spirit after he had repulsed Satan into Galilee. Luke 4:14. When Satan tempts a saint, he is but God's messenger. 2 Corinthians 12:7. There was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan, to buffet me. So our translation. But rather as Beza, who will have it, the messenger Satan, implying that he was sent of God to Paul. And indeed, the errand he came about was too good and gracious to be his own. Least I should be exalted above measure. The devil never meant to do Paul such a good office. But God sends Satan to Paul, as David sent Uriah with letters to Joab. Neither knew the content of their message. The devil and his instruments both are God's instruments. Therefore, the wicked are called his sword, his axe. Psalms 17:13, Isaiah 10:15. Now, let God alone to weld the one and handle the other. He is but a bungler that hurts and hackles his own legs with his own axe, which God should do if his children should be the worse for Satan's temptations. Let the devil choose his way. God is for him at every weapon. If he will try it by force of arms and assaults the saints by persecution as the Lord of hosts, he will oppose him. If by policy and subtlety he is ready there also, the devil and his whole council are but fools to God.
nay, their wisdom, foolishness, cunning, and art command every time everything but sin. The more artificial the watch, the picture, etc., the better. But the more wit and art in sin, the worse. Because it is employed against an all-wise God, that cannot be outwitted, and therefore will in the end but pay the workmen in greater damnation. The foolishness of God is wiser than men, yea, than the wisdom of men and devils, which is the means and instruments which God opposes Satan withal. What weaker than a sermon? Who's sillier than the saints in the account of the wise world? Yet God is wiser in a weak sermon than Satan in his deep plots, wherein the state heads of the whole concave of profound cardinals are not together. Wiser in his simple ones than Satan in his A-H-I-T-H-O-P-H-E-L-S and Sanballat. And truly God chooses on purpose to defeat the policies of hell and earth by these, that he may put such to greater shame. 1 Corinthians 1:21. How is the great scholar ashamed to be baffled by a plain countryman's argument? Thus God calls forth Job to wrestle with Satan and his seconds, for such his three friends showed themselves in taking the devil's part. And sure he is not able to hold up the cudgels against the fencing master, who is beaten by one of his scholars. God sits laughing, while heaven and while hell and earth sit plotting. Psalms 2:4. He disappointeth the devices of the crafty. He breaketh their studied thoughts and plots, as the words import. Job 5:12. In one moment pulling down the labors of many years' policy. Indeed, as great men keep wild beasts for game and sport, as the fox, the boar, etc., so doth God Satan and his instruments to manifest his wisdom in the taking of them. It is observed that the very hunting of some beasts afford not only pleasure to the hunter, but also more sweetness to the eater. Indeed, God, by displaying of his wisdom in the pursuit of his saints' enemies, does superadd a sweet relish to their deliverances at last. He break the head of the Leviathans in pieces, and give him to be meat to his people. After he hath hunted Pharaoh out of all his forms and morals, now he breaks the very brains of all his plots, and serves him up to his people with the garnishment of his wisdom and power about. The Christian in Complete Armor by William Grinnell. Ephesians 6, verse 11, chapter 5, chapter 9 of chapter 5. An account is given how the all-wise God doth outwit the devil in his tempting of saints to sin, wherein are laid down the ends Satan propounds, and how he is prevented in all, with the gracious issue that God puts to these his temptations. Question. But how doth God defeat Satan and outwit his willies in tempting his saints? Answer. This God doeth by accomplishing his own gracious ends for the good and comfort of his people. Out of those temptations from which Satan designs their ruin, this is the noblest kind of conquest, to beat back the devil's weapon to the wounding of his own head, yea, to cut it off with the devil's own sword. Thus God sets the devil to catch the devil, and lays, as it were, his own counsels under Satan's wings, and makes him hatch them. Thus the patriarchs helped to fulfill Joseph's dreams while they are thinking to rid their hands of him. To instant in a few particulars. Section 1. First, Satan by his temptations aim at the defiling of the Christian's conscience and disfiguring that beautiful face of God's image, which is engraven with holiness in the Christian's bosom. He is an unclean spirit himself, and would have them such, that he might glory in their shame. But God outwits him, for he turneth the temptations of Satan to sin, to the purging them from sin. They are the black soap with which God washes his saints white. First, God uses the temptations of Satan to one sin as a preventive against another. So, Paul's thorn in the flesh to prevent his pride. God sends Satan to a salt pole on that side where he is strong. And in the meantime, he may fortify him where he is weak. Thus Satan is befooled. As sometimes we see an army sitting down before a town, where it wastes its strength to no purpose, and in the meantime gives the enemy an advantage to recruit. And all this by the counsel of some Lucia, that is a secret friend to the contrary side. God, who is the saint's true friend, sits in the devil's council and overrules proceedings there to the saint's advantage. He suffers the devil to annoy the Christian with temptations to blaspheme atheism, and by these, together with the troubles of spirit they produce, the soul is driven to duty, is humbled in the sense of these horrid apparitions in its imagination, and secured from abundancy of formality and pride, which otherwise God saw invading him. As in a family, some business falls out which keeps the master up later than ordinary, and by this the thief, who that night intended to rob him, is disappointed. Had not such a soul had his spirit of prayer and diligence kept awake by those afflicting temptations, it is likely Satan might have come as a seducer and taken him napping in security. Secondly, God purges out the very sins Satan tempts to, even by his tempting. Peter never had such a conquest over his self-confidence, never such an establishment of his faith as after his foul fall in the high priest's hall. He that was so well persuaded of himself before, as to say, though all were offended with Christ, yet would not he. How modest and humble was he in a few days become, when he durst not say he loved Christ more than his fellow brethren, to whom before he had preferred himself. But an undaunted confessor of Christ, in his gospel, doth he prove before councils and rulers, who even now was dashed out of countenancy by a silly maid, and all this, the product of Satan's temptation, sanctifies unto him. Indeed, a saint hath a discovery by his fall. What is the prevailing corruption in him, so that the temptation doth but stir humor, which the soul, having found out, hath a greater advantage to evacuate by applying these means and using those ingredients which do purge that malady. Now the soul will call all out against this destroyer. Paul had not took such pains to buffet his body, had he not found Satan knocking at that door. Thirdly, God uses these temptations for the advancing of the whole work of grace in the heart. One spot occasions the whole garment to be washed. David, overcome with one sin, renews his repentancy for all. Psalms 51. A good husband, when he seeth it rain in at one place, sends for the workmen to look over all the house. This indeed differences a sincere heart from a hypocrite, whose repentance is partial, soft in one plot and hard in another. Judas cries out of his treason, but not a word of his thievery and hypocrisy. The hole was no wider in his conscience than where the bullet went in, whereas true sorrow for one breaks the heart into shivers for others also. Section 2. Secondly, Satan, by tempting one saint, hath a mischievous design against others, either by encouraging them to sin by the example of such a one, or discouraging them in their holy course by the scandal he hath given. But God here befools him, first making the miscarriages of such a seasonable caveat to others to look to their standing. Doth thou see a meek Moses provoked to anger? What watch and ward hast thou need keep over thy unruly heart? Though loud winds do some hurt by blowing down, here others tile and there a torrent, which was fallen before, yet the common good surmounts the private damage of some few, these being as a broom in God's hand to sweep and cleanse the air. So, though some that are wicked are by God's righteous judgment for the same hardened into further abominations by the saints' fall, yet the good which sincere souls receive by having their formality and security in a further degree purged doth abundantly countervailed the other, who are but sent a little faster, whither they are going before. Secondly, God makes the saints falls in argument for comfort to distressed consciences. This hath been, and it is as a feather, when the passage seems so stopped that no comfort can be got down otherwise, to drop a little hope into the soul, to keep the creature alive from falling into utter despair. Some have been revived with this when next door to hell in their own fears. David's sin was great, yet found mercy. Peter fell foully, yet now in heaven. Why sittest thou here, O my soul, under the hatches of despair? Up and call upon thy God for mercy, who hath pardoned the same to others. Thirdly, God hath a design in suffering Satan to trounce some of his saints by temptation, to train them up into a fitness to secure their fellow brethren in the like condition. He sends them hither to school, where they are under Satan's fury and lash, that his cruel hand over them may make them study the word and their own hearts, by which they get experience of Satan's policies, till at last they commence masters in this work of comforting tempted souls. It is an art by itself to speak a word in season to the weary soul. It is not serving out an apprenticeship to human arts. We'll furnish a man for this. Great doctors have proved great dunces here, knowing no more how to handle a wounded conscience than a rustic, the surgeon's instruments in dissecting the body when an anatomic lecture is to be read. It is not the knowledge of the scripture, though a man were as well acquainted with it as an apothecary with his pots and glasses in his shop, able to go directly to any promise of a sudden will suffice. No, not grace itself, except exercise with these buffetings and soul conflicts. Christ himself we find trained up in this school, Isaiah 50 verse 4. He waketh my ear to hear as the learned. Even as the tutor calls up his pupil to read to him, and what is the lecture which is read to Christ, that he may have the tongue of the learned to speak a word in season to the weary soul. See verse 5. The Lord hath opened my heart, my ear, and I was not rebellious, neither turned I away my back. I gave my back to the smiters, etc. His sufferings, which were all along mingled with temptations, were the lectures from which Christ came out, so learned to resolve and comfort distressed souls, so that the devil had better have let Christ alone, yea, and his saints also, who do him but the greater disservice in comforting others. None will handle poor souls so gently as those who remember the smart of their own heart sorrows, none so skillful in applying the comforts of the word to wounded consciences as those who have laid bleeding themselves. Such know the symptoms of soul trouble and feel others' pain in their own bosoms, which some that know the scriptures, for lack of experience, do not, and therefore are like a novel physician, who perhaps can tell you every plant in the herbal, yet wanting the practical part, when a patient comes, knows not well how to make use of his skill. The saints' experiences help them to a sovereign ointment made of the scorpion's own flesh, which they through Christ have slain, and that hath a virtue above all other to expel the venom of Satan's temptations from the heart. Section 3. Thirdly, Satan, in tempting the saint to sin, labors to make a breach between God and the soul. He hates both, and therefore labors to divide these dear friends. If I can, thinks he, get such a one to sin, God will be angry, and when angry, he will whip his child soundly. This will be some sport, and when God is correcting the saint, he will be questioning the love of God to him, and cool in his love to God. So, though I should not keep him from heaven at last, yet he shall have little joy in the way thither. In his case, God and the soul will be like a man and wife fallen out, who neither of them look kindly one upon another. Now see how God befools Satan in both these. First, God uses his saints' temptations as his method by which he advanced the communications of his love unto them. The devil thought he had got the goal when he got Adam to eat the forbidden fruit. He thought now he had men in the same predicament with himself, as unlikely ever to see the face of God as those apostate spirits. But alas, this was by God intended to usher in that great gospel plot of saving man by Christ, who, as soon as this prologue of man's fall is done, is brought upon the stage in that grand promise of the gospel made to Adam, and at God's command undertakes the charge of recovering lost man out of Satan's clutches and reinstalling him in his primitive glory with an ascension of more than ever man had at first, so that the meanest lily in Christ's field exceeds Adam in all his native royalty. And as Satan sped in his first temptation, so he is still on the losing hand. What got he by all his pains upon Job, but to let that holy man know at last how dearly God loved him? When he foiled Peter so shamefully, do we not find Christ owning Peter with as much love as ever? Peter must be the only disciple to whom, by name, the joyful news of the resurrection is sent. Go tell my disciples and Peter. As if Christ had said, be sure, let his sad heart be comforted with this news, that he may know I am friends with him for all his late cowardices. Question. But does not this seem to countenance sin and make Christians heedless whether they fall into temptation or no? If God does thus show his love to his saints after their falls and foils, why should we be so shy to sin, which ends well at last? Answer. Two things will prevent the danger of such an interference. First, we must distinguish between a soul's being foiled through his own infirmity and his enemy's subtlety and power overmatching him, and another, who through a false heart doth voluntarily prostrate himself to the lust of Satan, though a general will show little pity to a soldier that should treacherously throw down his arms and run to the enemy. Yet if another, in fighting, receives a wound, and be worse, it would be no dishonor for him to express his pity and love. No, though he should send him out of the field in his own coach, lay him in his own bed, and appoint him his own surgeon. God does not encourage wickedness in a saint, but pities weakness. Even when the saints fall into a sin in its natural presumptuousness, they do not commit it so presumptuously as others. There is a part true to God in their bosoms, though overvoted. Moses spake unadvisedly, but the devil had his instruments to provoke him against the good man's temper. David numbers the people, but sees how the devil dogged and hunted him, till at last he get the better. 1 Chronicles 21:1. Satan stood up and provoked David to number Israel. How bravely did Job repel Satan's darts. No wonder if in such a shower some one should get between the joints of his armor. And for Peter, we know with what a loyal heart, yea, zealous, he went into the field, though when the enemy appeared, his heart failed him. Secondly, consider but the way how God communicates his love after the saints fall, not in sinning or for sinning, but in mourning and humbling their souls for their sins. Indeed, did God smile on them while acting sinfully? This must strengthen their sin, as wine in a fever with the disease. But when the fit is off, the vehemence of the disease spent, and breathed out in a kindly humiliation, now the creature lies low. God's wine and comfort is a cordial to the drooping spirit, not fuel for sin. When David was led into temptation, first he must be clad in sackcloth and mourning, and then God takes it off and puts on the garment of joy and praise. 1 Chronicles 21:10-15. Job, though he expressed so much courage and patience, yet betraying some infirmities after he baited long so many fresh dogs, men, and devils, he must cry, Pekaver, P-E-C-C-A-V-I, and abhor himself in dust and ashes, before God will take him into his arms. Job 42:6. In the same way God takes with all his children. Now to his saints in such a posture,
God may with safety, to his honor and their good, give a larger draught of his love than ordinary. Their fears and sorrow, which their sin hath cost them, will serve instead of water to dash the strong wine of joy and take away its headiness, that it neither fume up into pride, nor occasion them to reel backward into apostasy. Question. Why does God now communicate his love? Answer. First, from his pitiful nature. You have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. God loves not to awaken bleeding wounds. He knows a mourning soul subject to be discouraged. A frowned or angry look from God, whom the saint so dearly loves, must needs go near the heart. Therefore God declares himself at hand to revive such. Isaiah 57, verse 15. And he gives the reason, verse 16. For I will not contend forever, neither I be always wrath, for the spirit should fail before me. Whose spirit is there met? Not of a presumptuous sinner, he goes on and never blinks, but of the contrite and humble ones. As a father observes the disposition of his children, one commits a fault and goes on rebelliously, despising his father's anger. Another, when offending, lays it to heart, refuses to eat, gets into some corner to lament the displeasure of his father. The father sees it, and his bowels yearn towards him. Indeed, should he not put his children out of fear by discovering his love? The spirit of such a one would fail. It is not possible there should be a long breach between such a father and such a son, the one relenting over his sin, the other over his mourning son. Secondly, God doeth thus to pour the greater shame upon Satan, who is the great mischief maker between God and the soul. How is the man ashamed that has stirred up variance between husband and wife, father and son, to see the breach made up, and all set themselves against him? It went ill on Christ's side when Herod and Pilate were made friends, and can it go well with Satan to see all well between God and his children? If Esther be in favor, Haman, her enemy, shall have his face covered. Indeed, this covers Satan's face with shame, to see a poor saint, even out of his prisoner, whom he had leave to rob and plunder, tempt and disquiet, now sitting in the sunshine of God's love, while he, like a raving lion, takes on for the loss of his prey. Secondly, Satan's aim is to weaken the saint's faith on God and cool his love to God, but befool them both, for first God turns their temptations, yea, their falls, to a further establishment of their faith, which, like the tree, stands stronger for its shaking, or like the giant Anteus, who in his wrestling with Hercules is fenced to get strength by every fall to the ground. False faith indeed, once foiled, seldom comes on again. The true faith rises and fights more valiantly, as we see in Peter and other scriptural examples. Temptation to faith is as fire to gold. 1 Peter 1:7. The fire does not only discover which is true gold, but makes the true gold more pure. It comes out maybe less in bulk and weight, because severed from the soil and dross, which embased it, but more in value and worth. When Satan is bound up, and the Christian walks under the light of divine favor and encouragement of divine assistance, faith may appear great, if compared with another under the withdrawings of God and buffetings of Satan. But this is not equal judgment, as if to try who is biggest of the two men. We should measure one naked and the other over his clothes, or in comparing two pieces of gold, weigh one with the dross and dirt he contracted in the purse, with the other purged from these in the fire. Faith before temptation hath much heterogeneous stuff in it that cleaves to it and goes for faith. But when temptation comes, these are discovered. Now the Christian feels corruption stir, which lay as dead before. Now a cloud comes between the soul and the sweet face of God, the sense of which later and the little sense of the other bore up his face before. But these bladders pricked, he comes now to learn the true stroke of his heavenly art of swimming on the promise, having nothing else to bear him up but that. When the little of this carries more of the precious nature of the faith in it than all the other, yea, is, like Gideon's handful of men, stronger, when all these accessories to faith are sent away, than when they were present. And here is all the devil gets. Instead of destroying his faith, which he aims at, he is the occasion of the refining of it, and thereby adding to its strength. Secondly, the love of tempted saints is enkindled to Christ by their temptations and foiled in their temptations. Possibly in the fit there may be seen a damp upon their love, as when water is first sprinkled upon the fire. But when the conflict is a little over and the Christian comes to himself, his love to Christ will break out like a vehement flame. First, the shame and sorrow which a gracious soul must needs feel in his bosom for his sinful miscarriage, while under the temptation, will provoke him to express his love to Christ above others, as is sweetly set forth in the spouse, who, when the cold fit of her distemper was off and the temptation over, bestirs her to purpose. Her lazy sickness was turned to love sickness. She finds it as hard now to sit as she did before to rise. She can rest in no place out of her beloved's sight, but runs and asks everyone she meets for him. And whence came all this vehemency for her zeal, all occasioned by her undutifully carriage to her husband? She parted so unkindly with him that, bethinking what she had done, away she goes to make her peace. If sins committed in unregeneracy have such a force upon a gracious soul, that the thought of them, though pardoned, will still break and melt the heart into sorrow, as we see in Magdalene, and pricked on to show zeal for God above others, as in Paul, how much more will the sins of a saint, who after sweet acquaintance with Jesus, lifts up the heel against the bosom where he hath lain, affect, yea, dissolve the heart, as in too many drops of water, and the soul provoke him to serve God at a higher rate than others. No child so dutiful in all the family as he who is returned from his rebellion. Again, secondly, as his own shame, so the experience with such a one hath of Christ's love above others will increase his love. Christ's love is fuel to ours. As it gives its being, so it affords growth. It is both mother and nurse to our love. The more Christ puts forth his love, the more heat our love gets. And next to Christ's dying love, none greater than his securing love in temptation. The mother never has such advantage to show her affection to her child as when in distress, sick, poor, or in prison. So neither hath Christ to his children as when tempted, yea, worse by temptation. When his children lie in Satan's prison, bleeding under the wounds of their own consciences, this is the season he takes to give an experiment of his tender heart in pitying his fatherlessness, in praying for them, his faithfulness in praying for them, his mindfulness in sending succor to them, yea, his dear love in visiting them by his comforting spirit. Now when the soul hath got off some great temptation and reads the whole history thereof together, wherein he finds what his own weakness was to resist Satan, nay, his unfaithfulness is in complying with Satan, which might have provoked Christ to leave him to the fury of Satan, now to see both his folly pardoned and ruin graciously prevented, and that by no other hand but Christ coming in to his rescue, as Abishai to David, 2 Samuel 21, when that giant thought to have slain him. This must needs exceedingly endear Christ to the soul. As the reading of such records, the Christian cannot but inquire, as Ahasuerus concerning Mordecai, who by discovering a treason hath saved the king's life. What honor hath been done to his sweet Savior for all this? And thus Jesus Christ, whom Satan thought to bring out of his soul's favor and liking, comes to an end to set higher and surer in the saint's affection than ever. The Christian in complete armor. Ephesians 6, verse 11, chapter 5, chapter 10, under 5. A brief application of the point in two branches. Use 1. This affords a reason why God suffers his little children,
to fall into temptation, because he is able to outshoot Satan in his own bow and in the thing wherein he thinks to outwit the Christian to be above him. God will not only be admired by his saints in glory for his love in their salvation, but for his wisdom in the way to him. The love of God in saving them will be the sweet draught at the marriage feast, and the rare wisdom of God in effectiveness as the curious workmanship with which the cup shall be enameled. Now, wisdom appears most in untying of knots and wading through difficulties. The more crosswords there are in a business, the more wisdom to fit a key to the lock, to make choice of such means as shall meet with the several turnings in the same. On purpose, therefore, doth God suffer much temptations to intervene, that his wisdom may be the more admired in opening all these, and leading his saints that way to glory, by which Satan thought to have brought them to hell. The Israelites are bid, remember all the way that God led them in the wilderness for 40 years. Deuteronomy 8, verse 2. The history of these wars, Christian, will be pleasant to read in heaven, though bloody to fight on earth. Moses and Elias talked with Christ on Tabor, an emblem of the sweet communion which shall pass between Christ and his saints in glory. And what was their talk? Luke 9, verse 30. But of his death and sufferings. It seems the discourse of our sufferings and temptations are not too low a subject for that blissful state. Indeed, this left out would make a blemish in the fair face of heaven's glory. Could the damned forget the way they went into hell, how oft the Spirit of God was wooing, and how far they were overcome by the conviction of it? In a word, how many turns and returns there were in their journey forward and backward. What possibilities they had for heaven, when on earth were but some hands so kind as to blot these tormenting passages out of their memories, it would ease them wonderfully. So were it possible glorified saints could forget the way wherein they went to glory, and the several dangers that intervened from Satan in their own backsliding hearts, they and their God, too, would be losers by it. I mean in regard of his manifested glory. What is the glory wherein God appears at Zion's deliverance? Those royal garments of salvation that made him admired of men and angels, but the celebration of all his attributes according to what everyone hath done towards their salvation? Now, wisdom being that which the creature chiefly glories in, and chosen by Satan for his first bait, who made Eve believe she should be like God in knowledge and wisdom, therefore God, to give Satan the more shameful fall, gives him leave to use his wits and willies in tempting and troubling his children, in which lies his great advantage over the saints, that so the way to his own throne, where his wisdom shall at last, as well as his mercy, set in all its royalty, may be paved with the skulls, as I may so speak, of devils. Secondly, this gives a strong cordial to our fainting faith in the behalf of the Church of Christ. If all the devil's wits and willies shall not serve him to overcome one single soldier in Christ's camp, much less shall he ever ruin the whole army. These are days of great confusions in the Christian world, and the chief fear of the gracious heart is for the ark, lest they should fall into the enemy's hand. And when this lady is taken, the city of God, his church, be trodden under the feet of pride. I confess Satan seems to get ground daily. He has strangely wiggled into the bosoms and principles of many, who by the fame of their profession and zeal had obtained, in the opinion of others, to be reckoned among the chief of Christ's worthies in their generation. He hath sadly corrupted the truths of Christ, brought a disesteem on ordinances, that by this, and as a judgment for this, the womb of the gospel has become, in a great measure, barren, and her children, which hang about her breasts, thrive not to love and holiness as of old, when the milk was not so much, nor that so spiritual. He hath had advantage by the divisions of the godly to harden those that are wicked into a further disdain of religion, and by the bloody wars of late years to boil up the wrath of the popish and profane crew to a higher pitch of rage and fury against Christ's little remnant than ever, so that if ever God should suffer the sword to fall into their hand, they are disciplined and fit to play the bloody butchers on Christ's sheep above their forefathers. Neither are they so crestfallen, but that they can hope for such a day, yea, take up some of those joys upon thrust aforehand to solace themselves while the rest follow. And now, Christian, may be their confidence, together with the distracted state of Christian affairs in the world, may discompose thy spirit concerning the issues of those rolling providences that are over our heads, but be still, poor heart, and know that the contest is not between the church and Satan, but between Christ and him. These are the two champions. Stand now, O ye army of saints, still by faith to see the all-wise God wrestle with a subtile devil. If you live not to see the period of these great confusions, yet generations after you shall behold the Almighty smite off this Goliath's head with his own sword and take this cunning hunter in the toil of his own policies at faith, which ascribes greatness and wisdom to God, will shrink up Satan's subtlety into a thing of nothing. Unbelief fears Satan as a lion. Faith treads on him as a worm. Behold, therefore, thy God at work, and promise thyself that what he is about will be an excellent peace. None can drive him from his work. The pilot is beaten from the helm and can do little in a storm, but let the ship go adrift. The architect cannot work when night draws the curtain, yea, has driven off the scaffold with a storm of rain. Such workmen are the wisest counselors and mightiest princes on earth. A pinch may come when it is as vain to say, "Help, O king," as "Help, O beggar." Man's wisdom may be leveled with folly, but God is never interrupted. All the plots of hell and commotions on earth have not so much as shaken God's hand to spoil one letter or line that he hath been drawing. The mysteriousness of his providence may hang a curtain before his work, but we cannot see what he is doing. But then, when darkness is about him, righteousness is the seat of his throne forever. Oh, where is our face, sirs? Let God be wise in all men and devils fools. What, though thou seest a Babel more likely to go up than a Babylon to be pulled down, yet believe God is making his secret approaches and will clap his ladders on a sudden to the walls thereof? Therefore, truth were a prisoner with Joseph, and error the courtier, to have its head lifted up by the favor of time, yet dost not remember that the way of truth's preferment lies through the prison? Yea, what though the church were like Jonah in the whale's belly, swallowed up to the eye of reason by the fury of men, yet doth not remember the whale had not power to digest the prophet? Oh, be not too quick to bury the church before she be dead. Stay while Christ tries his skill before you give it over. Bring Christ by your prayers to its grave to speak a resurrection word. Admirable hath the saint's faith been in such strength as Joseph's, who pawned his bones that God would visit his brethren, willing them to lay him where he believed they should be brought. Jeremiah purchased a field of his uncle and pays down the money for it. And when the Chaldean army quartered about Jerusalem, ready to take the city and carry him with the rest into Babylon, and all this by God's appointment, Jeremiah 22, verses 6-8, that he might show the Jews by this how undoubtedly he, in that sad juncture of time, did believe the performance of the promise for their return out of captivity. Indeed, God counts himself exceedingly disparaged in the thoughts of his people, though at the lowest ebb of his church affairs, if this naked word and the single bond of his promise will not be taken as sufficient security to their faith as its deliverance. end of Ephesians 6, verse 11.